which is also known as an homomorphic logic and Pyongbin interpretation. In several places, it has different names. Okay, so just to let you know that it's the same thing. Yeah, so in the talk, I'll give a couple of motivational remarks, and then I'll essentially introduce the coevent formulation. And then after introducing the coevent formulation, I'll talk about five different aspects that I want to address within this formulation. The one is what is happening with the Cohen-Specker theorem in this formulation. The second is what we mean by classicality and the existence of a unique classical domain. How to make probabilistic predictions, and well, a few things about logic, and a few remarks at the end about the relation, well, how to understand the recent argument of Poussey, Barrett, and Rudolph that they made about not being able to interpret statistically the wave function in the context of coevents. So, yeah. Yeah, so as initial motivation, well, there is twofold essentially of this history, the one of this formulation. The one is that we want to be able to deal with the quantum mechanics of closed system. This is necessary for if we want to speak about quantum cosmology. And for this case, we would like an understanding of quantum theory, an interpretation or formulation that is realistic. So we can speak about properties of the objects without having to deal with the observer, because in the universe there are no external observers. And the second is that quantum theory is space and time are not in the same background, in the same footing, which this is the source of the problem of time in quantum gravity. So it is believed that it could a more natural formulation of quantum theory would involve histories. And coevent formulation is exactly this, is a realistic, well, not exactly realistic, but as realistic as, well, not as realistic as it could get, as I think it could get, and is a history interpretation, well, formulation of quantum theory. And, yeah. So first I'll talk about the structure that we use if we want to talk about in classical physics using histories. So there is three structures that we need. The first structure is the space of histories. So it contains all the possible histories. So points in this history space omega are, say, full trajectories of the subject of the system, or it could involve internal degrees of freedom. So and then associated with this history space is the collection of subsets of the history space, which would form a Boolean algebra. So this Boolean algebra we call U. And each of these of the subsets of the history space we call an event. Now, in classical physics, a single history is actually realized. One of these elements, one of these fine grained H1, H2, whatever. Now, I want any physical question that we would like to ask essentially corresponds to a subset of this of omega, an element of U. So, for example, if we want to say that the particle at time t1 is in this interval delta, then it's just is the subset that corresponds to all the histories that at this time have the particle here. So anything that we would like to ask corresponds to a subset of the history space. And now the initial conditions and the dynamics of our theory determine which history is actually realized. This is in deterministic classical physics. In general, we could have a measure omega on the history space. So this would correspond to stochastic classical physics. And in this case, the only definite predictions that we can make is about things that have measure zero, and we say that these things do not occur. And this is what we call preclusion, and we're going to need it later in the quantum theory a lot. One property, which is quite obvious for classical histories, is that we cannot have a cover of the history space. Cover, I mean, a collection of subsets that their union is omega, such that each of these subsets has a measure zero. This is not possible in classical physics. And yeah, that's trivial in classical physics, but it's not the case in the quantum physics. Now the second structure is the space of truth values, which in classical physics is just true or false. And that also has a Boolean structure. And the third structure we require to speak about physics in using histories is valuation maps. So valuation maps are maps from the set of subsets of omega from U to T. which assign a truth value to each subset. Therefore, it assigns a truth value, true or false, to any possible question. These maps, we call them coevents. Now, in classical physics, these maps need to respect the Boolean structure, well, of U and T. And therefore, they have to be homomorphisms. So it means that the symmetric difference of two questions is just the sum of the truth values, and the intersection of two subsets is the product phi alpha phi b. These coevents that correspond to this classical to these homomorphisms are called classical coevents. We will refer to homomorphic coevents as classical coevents in the rest of the talk. Now, in deterministic physics, a system follows just a unique history. Now, with each history, there exists a map, a homomorphic map, which is defined in this way. So for a given history, I can define a map that is homomorphic, that gives the value truth for every question that contains this history, and gives the value false if it doesn't contain this history. Therefore, it's a characteristic map of the single history. And one can show that these homomorphic maps are in one-to-one correspondence with the single histories. Now, in stochastic physics, there exists a classical measure on omega. Therefore, the possible realities are the many. We don't have a single history that is realized. There are many histories, and thus there are many maps or classical coevents that are potential realities for history. Now, in quantum theory, we can assign some probability amplitudes to histories by the Feynman integral. So we put some complex number like this. Now, I suppose... You
know, what's the origin of the term co-event? What is that supposed to tell us?
Well, it's kind of dual to the event. So it's, in a sense, so event is the questions, the alpha.
An event is some like measurable subset of the space.
Well, yes, yes. And co-event is something like a dual. Because it's the map that, in classical physics there is a one-to-one correspondence between them, and we will see that there is some relation between these two in this co-event formulation as well, but not exactly like that. Okay. Yeah. I suppose most of you are familiar with the decoherent histories formulation quantum theory, or are you? Anyway, so in order to define interference between histories, they use the decoherence functional, which obeys these properties. And essentially, it's the weight of the histories B times the complex conjugate of the weight that corresponds to the other history. And they obey these properties, so bilinearity, hermeticity, non-negativity, and normalization. Now the diagonal terms that we saw that are non-negative is just the mod square of the Feynman amplitude, and they are called candidate probabilities in the decoherent histories because they correspond to the probability of that coarse-grained history to be realized under certain circumstances that I'll say later. Now these diagonal terms are also called quantum measure if it's viewed with some other point of view, but it is the same object, and it is called quantum measure because it's not an actual measure. It doesn't obey the additivity of disjoint regions of the sample space. So if you have A and B disjoint, the quantum measure is not equal with the sum of the quantum measure. The most famous example of this is the double slit due to interference. Now, for the decoherent histories, if we have a partition is a cover of the space with disjoint regions, disjoint sets. So if we have a partition such that the off-diagonal terms of the coherence functional vanish, then the probability sum rule is obeyed, and this partition generates what is called a consistent set. So this is in the coherent histories. And one of the problems that we'll see later what is happening is that there isn't a unique consistent set in the coherent histories. Now, while we said that the quantum measure is not a proper measure, it doesn't obey the Kolmogorov sum rule, the one I mentioned before, but it does obey this weaker thing. So if we have three disjoint histories. We can deduce the quantum measure from the individual quantum measures and the pairs of the interfering pairs. So there is no new phenomena in the three-slit experiment, so to speak. There is no three-path interference. Now, using this quantum measure to derive predictions and to interpret reality is the issue, and here is what is different in this formulation. Here it starts where we deviate from coherent histories. Now, what's the problem with quantum theory? So we notice that there is a quantum measure rather than a normal measure. So and this implies that we can't have a cover of omega with sets that have zero quantum measure. So we will speak in detail about this later, which corresponds to the Cohen-Sperger theorem. Well, this in effect results that it's impossible to maintain the picture of classical physics, of classical physics and Boolean logic. There is no homomorphism between the space U, the of subsets of omega, and the truth values, true or false, this two Boolean algebra. There is no homomorphism. And of course, one can think we had three structures, there are three solutions to change the one, the second, or the third. So, yeah.
So I remember the question, it might be a bit pedantic, so feel free to ignore it. But when you say it's not a normal measure, it's a quantum measure, I wonder if what's at issue there is the same issue with the two-slit case where, you know, people talk about the two-slit case as violating probability because the probabilities don't add properly. But you can just understand that as that you're trying to compare probabilities that are conditioned on different physical setups, you know, whether one slit is open or one slit is closed. So it's not that you violate probability theory, it's just that you're comparing probabilities that are conditioned on things.
Yeah, I didn't say whether I violate probability. The only thing I said that I have an omega and mathematical object that obeys this condition of quantum measure and not the one of Kolmogorov-Sum rule. I didn't give any interpretation to this. I just said that the object that lies on omega is this thing that we call quantum measure, and it's not a measure, just this. I mean, this is a mathematical fact, it's not...
My question is...
The interpretation will come in a bit, I mean.
Oh, fair enough.
And the thing is that... we'll see that there is an issue of realism if you want to maintain the same picture that you had with classical measure when you have quantum measure, exactly because of this second thing. When we reach Cohen-Sperger theorem in co-events, that might become clearer. So the three solutions is to change U, change the truth values, or change the maps. So the first, if one wants to change U...
When you say there's no homomorphism, you mean there's no homomorphism such that it respects preclusion or something like that?
Yes.
So
that it respects too. that it respects the quantum measure. Yeah. So the three solutions. The one is to change U instead of considering the set of all possible questions, the set of all possible events, to restrict attention to some preferred subset of questions. And this is essentially what is done in consistent histories. We don't look the full. The full Boolean algebra of U, but we just look at a subset that is consistent. However, the problem in that is that there is an arbitrary choice of which subset to consider, which classical subset to consider, and that's an issue. The second is to alter the truth values. That's, I think, what ISAM has been doing. The resulting thing is that can get the deductive logic, but is contextual, if I've understood it correctly. So this is a viable alternative, but then one might need to understand exactly what contextual logic means. So it's, that's it. Other than mathematically, I mean. Yeah. So the third thing is that to allow the maps from U to T not being homomorphic. Of course, they cannot be arbitrary, whatever we would like, because then they would be, we wouldn't be able to argue or anything. So we will see what conditions we give. So we need to do it in a controlled way to maintain deductive power of the resulting logic. And that's basically the equivalent formulation. So the initial thing is that what we do is we keep multiplication. So we keep that the intersection of two sets is the intersection of two events is given by the product of the valuation of this term. But we drop addition. So symmetric difference, you can think if A and B are disjoint, this is just that the A union B is not equal with phi A plus phi B. The symmetric difference is that. Now, so we keep that. This is the first condition. We'll come to more conditions that we require. If this is kept, as we'll see later, mod exponents, which is essentially the basic inference rule, it still holds. So very roughly speaking, it's that if a coevent is true, and a coevent, well, if an event is true, and the event, and this event is subset of another event, then this other event is also true. However, if something is false, we cannot say that its complement is right. So this is where the anhomomorphism is encoded, and there is where the quantum paradox is lie. So the thing is to show that this is not this doesn't contradict our experience. Note, however, that a small asymmetry between these two. If something is true, then its complement is false. That still holds in our case. It's only this that doesn't hold. Okay. Now, one can see that for any multiplicative coevent, there exists some subset A that this coevent is characteristic map of this set. It means that it gives the truth value true for any set that contains A, and false for any other. So if this set A was a single history, then we're back to classical coevents. So we call this subset A phi the support of the coevent.
When you call a coevent multiplicative, do you just mean phi of A in section B is phi A phi B?
Yes.
Yeah.
Note that a lot of what I say is very clear. It's clear for finite dimensional history space, and a bit more care is needed if considered. Infinite dimensional history spaces. But just keep this in mind. Now it essentially means that we don't have a single history as being realized as in classical physics. However, we can view that the reality is a subset. And this subset of histories is realized. So if we have this subset is just two histories, anything that contains those two is right. Anything that doesn't contain none of them is false. So far we are in homomorphism. And homomorphism comes when we ask a question that contains the one history and doesn't contain the other, because then both histories are false. So this is false, the complement is also false. It's the only anhomomorphism we have. So if these supports are small enough, the anhomomorphism or the quantum paradoxes are restricted in, say, micro world, so to speak. So other than the above weakening, of course, we have two more conditions to the allowed coevents. The first is where physics enters, is what Rafael said before, that we require that these coevents, they give truth value for an event false if the measure of this event is zero. That's desirable. We want something that has quantum measure not occurring, so it's false. Such coevents we call preclusive. So note that in this part is where dynamics and initial condition enter the picture. Is where we use this quantum measure, which the Hamiltonian initial condition enters. Before it was everything like kinematical. This is where the dynamics enter. Now, the second condition is that we select the smaller subsets in some sense that are multiplicative and preclusive. So if we have a subset A and a subset B that has contains A, and they both obey multiplicativity and preclusivity, we take the smaller one as a possible reality. And we do this because we want to keep as close as to single histories as possible, because we want the finest description that is allowed by our history. And those coevents are called primitive preclusive coevents. Primitive is this smaller condition. These primitive preclusive coevents, and these are the potential realities in quantum theory in this approach. And we call coevent formulation because the ontology of the theory is these primitive preclusive coevents. We have many possible coevents, and the one realized is not fixed by the quantum measure, and that's very similar to classical stochastic physics rather than classical deterministic physics. So one can view that quantum theory is generalization of classical stochastic physics rather than deterministic physics. And this formulation was initiated by Rafael in those papers and then developed by several other people. So now the Cohen-Sperker theorem in the coevent formulation. Okay, Cohen-Specker theorem, as well, very roughly speaking, as you know, I suppose, is that if the dimension of the Hilbert space is greater or equal than 3, we cannot consistently assign value to all observables, including the non-commuting observables. Now, this thing translates in the history's context with the following paradox. Essentially, it's the same thing, that we can have a classical cover of omega, a cover, as we said, that each of the sets in the cover has quantum measure zero. What we said, it was not possible for classical physics to cover the full history space with measure zero sets. We can do for if the measure is quantum measure. So that's that may answer partly your question earlier, because the fact that it's a quantum measure, this object that lies on the history space, doesn't allow us any longer to have a single history as being realized, because we can have this type of quantum of cover of the space. But it does allow us to have quantum co-events which are thicker than single histories. And this the analysis of this particular the Cohen-Specker theorem was done in the language of co-events by Dauker, Gazeta, Batabai, and Now, the thing is that if we assume that no subset B of measure zero can occur, then leads to the paradox that there isn't a single history, not a single history can be realized. So there is no classical co-event for the cases that we have this classical cover. A simplified example, not exactly like Cohen-Specker, is if we consider a three-slit experiment and the spot on the screen such that A and B interfere destructively, B and C also interfere destructively at this point, so the quantum measure is zero. However, the total quantum measure for crossing any of the three slits is non-zero. So when we observe it, we realize that sometimes it hits the screen at this point. However, the space is covered by histories of quantum measure zero. So in this example, we can't say that the particle crossed slit A. That's not allowed because it's a subset of this, or that crossed B, or that it crossed C. But we can say that it was the coevent was AC. The subset AC, it doesn't belong, is not a subset of any measure zero set. And in this case, this is the only allowed coevent. In general, we have more than one allowed coevent. In this case, this is the only allowed coevent.
This is what we call the three box paradox.
Slit.
But there's another version of it, yeah. That's which is isomorphic to it. Yeah, that's that
Weidman
and is it Aharon? No. Maybe Aharon not from Weidman. And Weidman as well.
Yeah. So the notion of a classical cover can be replaced by that of a quantum cover. A quantum cover, roughly speaking, is a classical cover, but has some more subsets, so it's more nested than a classical cover. And it can be shown that this, well, it's quite technical what a quantum cover is, and it can be shown that no quantum cover can exist with measure zero sets, because if that was the case, then the total measure of the history space would be zero. And because of this, because there is no quantum cover, one can show, actually, we had shown in that paper with Surya, that there always exists at least one or actually at least two coevents, which means that the problem that there was there in Cohen-Specker theorem is not there in coevents. Okay, maybe they're not fine-grained enough, the coevents, but they always exist at least one coevent. And the analysis of the Cohen-Specker, the proof of the Cohen-Specker can, in the language coevents can be found in these two papers I mentioned before. Now, what can we say about classicality? Okay, this is not the end of the story, but about how classicality actually emerges, but it's just, first of all, defining what we mean by classicality in this language. So classical physics we expect to arise when, if we cross-grain sufficiently, then we have a resulting homomorphism. We have a Boolean logic in the cross-grained history, cross-grained Boolean algebra. What we want is that if we want this classical partition to be such that independently which coevent is actually realized, to have a homomorphism. So, and this, so we won't say that we have a partition, a classical partition, and the cells of the partition is Ci, so they are, their union is omega, and they are, it's a partition, basically. And that requires that for all supports of the allowed coevents, there exists one of these cells, this classical partition, that the coevent lies exactly within it. So this classical partition doesn't cut any of the possible coevents. This would be a classical partition. And one can show, I'll mention briefly how, that there exists a unique finest grain classical partition. Therefore, all classical partitions arise as quadraining of this finest grained partition. And this was an interesting result. So actually, this is not the case in consistent histories. How one does this? If the coevent, well, it's simple and to say how it does. So if the supports do not overlap the supports of the possible coevents, then we just take the supports of these coevents as being cells of the classical partition, and then the rest space is just single histories cells. Now, if they overlap, then we need to take the transitive closure of this. So we take, if one overlaps with this, then take their union. And if it overlaps with another, then the total union of them. And then this is a cell of the classical partition. And again, the rest space is covered by single history cells. And then one can show that this partition, any classical partition that you would have, is just a cograining of this partition that I described here. Okay, so this is not the case in consistent histories, where there are many consistent sets that they cannot arise as cograining of a unique finest grain consistent set. And therefore, to interpret consistent histories, one needs something more. It's not there yet. Yeah. Well, yes. So either he has to prefer a consistent set that is preferred for some reason, maybe due to some extra physical assumption, or to keep all the consistent sets and have a contextual view. But then the probabilities of histories depends on which consistent set or classical domain, in other words, uses. So one of the two. On the other hand, in coevents are not contextual, so they maintain a more classical realistic view.
Yeah. I just want to ask a question to make sure I'm following you. It seems to me like you're specifying an arena in which classical logic can be applied as opposed to a criterion for when the physics is classical. So in the double slit experiment, we would say, well, if there's no decoherence between the slits, and that's, you know, quantum physics, not classical physics. But you'd still say that, you know, we can ask what sorts of histories admit of classical logic, and it would be sort of the trivial history where you don't distinguish which of the two slits the particle went through.
Is that and actually, it wouldn't be that. It would be the coevents.
Well, it would be the AC coevent.
No, this is in the three slits.
In any case, the idea that you're sort of trying to have a criterion for the applicability of classical logic as opposed to the applicability of classical physics, I have that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because still we haven't speak about how probability, because the rest, other than speaking with logic about the properties of the system, we also need to speak about probabilities, I suppose. And this is the way it's introduced in this formulation to complex. About this. Okay, yeah.
But I think probably what you're getting at, there's a large part of what we mean by the classical world is the classical logic applied. I think that would be what's being maintained here.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, you know, Maxwell's equation built or something like that. It means, but I think another way of saying it is that, you know, if you express the problem in terms of, say, the measurement problem, how does the measurement problem look in this way of thinking? And the way it looks is that you might not get a unique outcome if you did a measurement. In that case, classical logic wouldn't apply. But if classical logic does apply, then it implies that you do get a unique outcome, right? Because you have, say, two possible outcomes, outcome one, outcome two, say they're complements to each other. So if that extra rule is satisfied, that if one of them doesn't happen, the other one does happen, then you have a unique outcome. So the statement, on the other hand, the other rule that if the first one happens, the second one doesn't happen, that's already there in this multiplicative scheme. But what's not there is that at least one of them does happen. But if classical logic applies, then it is true that at least one of them, and therefore the unique one does happen. And in that sense, that resolves the, if you could show that, that these outcome events were part of this classical algebra, then that would resolve, that's how the resolution of the measurement problem would look.
Okay. For me, I guess it was just the expression emergence of classicality kind of threw me off. That often when people say, I want to explain the emergence of classicality, what they want to come up with is maybe a criterion for when classical physics might be sufficient to describe all the experimental predictions you've seen.
Yeah.
Right. Here it seems to me there'll be scenarios where the experimental predictions are not consistent with the classical theory, but you might still say, what about those predictions can I reason using classical logic, and what can I not? And that's what your criterion establishes.
That's right. And I mentioned that that's not the title, Emergence of Classicality. So this is not the end of the story. This is just a few things about classicality in this formulation. There is a lot more to be said about even how classical physics, in the sense you define, arises. Anyway. Now I'll say a couple of things, how we use probabilities in this formulation. Now I'll say some general things about probabilities before I enter exactly what is happening here. Now, physical prediction should be able to be falsified by the outcome of some experiment. Okay, that's well known. Now, so what we do is we construct a model of how the world is, initial condition and dynamics, and then using this we make a proposition about the state of the world. Now, the experimental outcome should be in position to deduce whether the proposition was true or false. Now, the meaning of probability for a single system has been an issue of debate since the beginning of probability theory. And so, for example, if we have the statement the universe is at state x with probability 1/3, there is an issue which is a physical relevance, because any outcome, whether it possesses the property or not, doesn't falsify this sentence. So in some sense, is this a scientific question? We can no experimental outcome can falsify it, so it's not. So one way to understand the meaning of probability and how we use it in practice to obtain physical prediction is via Cournot principle. That's I've been arguing from the beginning of probability theory, Paul Mogorov. So the strong version of this Cournot principle, which is not what we actually use, a weaker version we'll see later, is that in a repeated trial, an event A of small measure does not occur. Now, here, not that we say nothing about a single closed system. We can only speak about subsystems that are in some sense similar. So if we are saying that the probability of a coin to come heads is a half, it means that if we consider all the coins in the universe, or, well, in the room, whatever, which are similar subsystems, we are bound to get a distribution heads-tails which is close to 50%. That's essentially what we mean when we say that the probability of the coin coming a half is. However, this strong Cournot principle, it does contradict experience, because actually any series of outcomes of heads tail, it has the same probability with anything else, and it's very, very small. So we can't actually take it too seriously. But what we can take is this, the weaker version of the Cournot principle, which says that in a repeated trial, an event A singled out in advance, this is the important thing, of small measure will not occur. So we consider pre-selected events. To clarify how this works, I'll give basically one example. So, exaggeration. Okay, so assume that we have a classical fair coin, so heads and tails is half probability, and the probability for any series of outcomes is a half to the n. So the probability to get n minus one heads is, that's not probability, that's the probability. And the probability of getting half of them heads is, to divide by 2 to the n, this thing. Every single history, every single of this is approximately precluded. So it has very small measures. So if we want to adopt strong Cournot principle, we wouldn't be able to have any reality to be realized. However, if before we toss the coin n times, we ask the question, will it come n minus 1 times head? This we will see it's smaller than epsilon, while the question, will it come half times head, is not, because it has, well, in the case that n equals 10, we can see that, well, the probability is 100 that we have 9 heads, and it's much bigger to have a half, it's 1/4 to have a 5, whatever. So, so as we said, strong Cournot is excluded because from experience. Weak Cournot, now we have a separation between the ontology and the predictions of this theory. So the ontology is all possible outcomes of series. We don't, because anything that doesn't have measure exactly zero is an allowed conceivable reality. However, the predictions we make is we preselect a question. We preselect, for example, the question, it was all heads. Now, if we toss the coin and it actually does come 1,000 times heads, this is conceivable, this is ontologically allowed. But if this happens, we will say that our initial assumption that the coin was fair is wrong. We will, even if it's conceivably true, we will come to a conclusion to falsify our initial assumption that it was a fair coin. And this is actually what we do in practice. Even if something with extremely, extremely small probability occurs, then we usually assume that our initial theory was our initial statement
but
was
in
wrong.
But your point about the strong corner principle, you made the point that any sequence of outcomes is extremely unlikely.
Yes, that's why.
So, okay, so you're just choosing. I don't know. I don't quite follow what you're saying.
Yeah.
Here.
So there is the concept of preselect. Of course, after I toss the coins, any series of outcome would be precluded. But if before I carry out the experiment, I say something that has very small. So if before I toss the coin, I say that it will come head, tails, 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 head, head. I give you a series. And I toss the coin, it actually does turn out to be this the case. And I'll say, oh, actually, it was not fair. Somebody who heard what I said and fixed it like this. So that's what I say, because it's preselected.
But I mean, you're preselecting the case where they're all heads and not preselecting all the others. So then the choice of which ones you're going to preselect seems pretty arbitrary.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that my prediction is I select a subset. So instead of this, the heads, tails, I could, my question could be coarser. For example, that there is a distribution, well, okay, it's not a distribution because it's just two outcomes, but in other cases, it could be a distribution. So that it's 70% heads or 50% heads. I select a question from before.
Suppose I pre-selected a sequence of heads and tails where it's 50-50 and it was random, just some arbitrary sequence.
Yes.
And then that sequence happened. I wouldn't be particularly amazed. I wouldn't say there was anything wrong with my assumption.
I would.
But if I pre-selected one where they're all heads, and I said that's not going to happen, then it does. I think the coin isn't fair.
I don't agree. If I pre-select a series of 1,000 outcomes, not heads, 50% heads and 50% tails, but a particular series, and I toss the coin and I find that actually this came, I'll try to find who was reading my mind and fix the coin. That's what I would do.
Yeah, I
wouldn't assume that it was a fair the coin.
Some bad intuition you've got there based on typical versus atypical sequences.
I think that's what I would do.
They're equally unlikely, even though one seems more likely because it's more typical. But in fact, it's as unlikely as we all have.
I mean, I would be very surprised if somebody.
I mean, I don't think you're treating them the same at all.
I do, I think. We can discuss
this. I mean, for instance, if I buy a lottery ticket, so that's my pre-selection, and then I actually win, I don't conclude that the lottery is unfair.
Well,
I just think I've been.
Maybe
lucky.
I conclude that there is God winning the lottery. I don't know. Okay, I'm just kidding.
But sold it to you, told you that number is going to win, and you won, then you might think it's unfair.
That I had some internal information.
But I mean, the case where I just arbitrarily pre-select. Anyway, I should let you go on.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I agree. I mean, why is this an unlikely event not possible? I mean, they happen.
Actually, I don't really.
No, I didn't say that it's not conceivably possible, but I said that.
Well, I thought that it's not what strong Cournot possible reality.
Yes, but strong Cournot is excluded.
What?
I said strong Cournot, we don't use strong Cournot. We use weak Cournot. Strong Cournot, of course, is that's falsified by experience. We all the time get things that have very small probability.
Right.
That's definitely not true. But we use the weak kernel. That's what I said.
So I seem to have missed the motivation for why this digression about what's considered possible and not possible based on the probability. How does this fit into
the quagan?
These last three slides about when you consider.
Well, then we have the quantum case. This is the classical case.
Oh, I see.
Because essentially the predictions, we are speaking about a closed system. Eventually, the prediction that we are going to get is things that have a quantum measure very small. So if we want to recover probability, well, one can claim that the only real probability that you can speak about is essentially about things that are almost precluded, so that they have measure or quantum measure, in our case, very small. So this is an argument why not all probabilities are meaningful for a closed system. And what we really mean when we use probabilities is essentially this type of thing. And this is not really new in probability theory. I mean, the first people that were reasoning of what is probability, that's what they said. I mean, that's what some of them supported. So this is not, this is one view of probability. One view of probability is that probability is all about the weak kernel principle and nothing else. So, and we adopt this point of view. We can discuss why we discuss this at the end. Yeah, I'm running quite low on time. Yeah. So in quantum physics, well one example is, okay, this is a very simplified example. I'm not going to get into many details. It's a double slit. We have a discrete screen. There are five slots in the screen. So J goes from -2, -1, 0, 1, 2. And these are the quantum measures for single histories, and these are for pair of histories. We see due to interference that, well, in the middle there are more unlikely than the other ones. So this gives the quantum measure for this, and assume we just take the 10 repetitions. It's not important the details how we get this. The idea is that if we get the probability to get a uniform distribution in this, and of course if we had more points in the screen and more particles, it would be bigger the difference, is about 1/10 than having a probability distribution that resembles the double slit. So if we chose the cutoff epsilon, what we call approximate preclusion, to be assume this, then we would say that the double slit pattern is not precluded, so it's a viable solution, while the uniform distribution, it is precluded. And if we had more particles, the difference between these two would be much even bigger. Now I'm not going to enter too big detail. There is one argument why we could try to attempt strong Cournot principle in quantum theory, why we don't in classical. But eventually it fails, so I'm not going to speak about it too much. Essentially, if we took the conditions, the preclusivity condition, instead of being for A event being equal to zero, being for A being less than epsilon, this cutoff. But this eventually doesn't work, so just ignore it. And let's go to the weak Cournot to understand how it works. So basically, the ontology is still, the possible realities are still these primitive preclusive coefficients, as earlier. Now, the predictions we can make, we need to use the quantum measure mu. And in order to make predictions, we need to preselect some questions and see if they confirm or falsify our statement. So, for example, the question was, can we have a uniform distribution? It's falsified because it has very small quantum measure. Now, an important point is that these preselected questions that we shall ask, they should be chosen in such a way not to intersect the support of any coevent. So they have to be classical questions, one of the things we need to take care of. And this is just not a very important note. OK, so we can talk about probability later, because it's an interesting issue, but there are more to say now. The other thing is more respondents and deductive logic. So we have altered the set of possible maps, allowing for unhomomorphisms. Now, however, we still require to encode some of the structure of U to T, because we want to be able to make this type of arguments. Well, human have two hands, it's true. Plato was human, true. And we want to be able to deduce that actually Plato had two hands. So that's the type of thing we want to keep. Yeah, this is not a very important thing. Now, A, R, or B, this is A implied B. This is what is called material implication. And it's, well, it's given by the Venn diagram here. And it's it means if A, then B. So if A is false, then the implication is trivially true. If it is false, then it's true only if it lies in the intersection of A and B. So this is the material implication. Now, in order to reason, one needs the inferences rules, and the most vital one for deductive logic is the modus ponens. Actually, modus ponens is the short for modus ponendo ponens, which is the Latin word to say the way to that affirms by affirming. So anyway, it's funny, but that's what it is. Yeah. So modus ponens says that if we have the sentence, if P then Q is true, P implies Q is true, and the sentence P is also true, we deduce that the sentence Q is also true. This is what modus ponens is. Well, its validity in classical physics is guaranteed because phi are homomorphisms. Now, for example, in the example I gave, being human is the set A, having two hands is the set B. For any phi that is realized, we have A implies B. It's true, and along with the assumption that our object of interest, which was Plato, is indeed human, therefore phi of A is 1, results to the deduction that phi of B is also 1, that Plato had two hands. This example again. Now, a note is that in classical physics we can make proofs not only with modus ponens, but also by contradiction, that if something is true, then the complement is false, and if something is false, its complement is true. These are not possible in our in quantum theory. Actually, the one is the other, isn't it? So in quantum theory, this picture is not valid because it's not homomorphic. We don't have homomorphic. So let's, for example, forget that we took multiplicative coefficients and start from the beginning. We start and we need to keep the structure such that modus ponens holds, and unitality. Unitality is the condition that something happens. Phi of omega is true, just this, that something very vaguely happens. So if we start with these two conditions, then one can show that necessarily the map that we'll end up has to be multiplicative. So that's a very nice feature of the multiplicative coefficients that we took. This is a good, yeah. So basically, the rest just proves that this thing is a sketch of how I prove this.
Is it an if and only if, or?
It is. It's the converse theorem, evaluation map phi that is multiplicative or Bayes necessarily the modus ponens. Actually, it's not if and only if because the unitality condition is not, I think, there. But anyway, it exists the almost converse of theorem one. Yeah. So, okay, one can show, first shows the filter property that if something is true, then any set that contains this is also true. And from this, the opposite, one can very easily show that if something is false, then anything that is subset of this is also false. This follows from this. And then one can also show that if A and B is true, then their intersection has also have to be true. All this provided that modus ponens and unitality holds. This is our conditions, how we prove these things. So in all this, we assume that modus ponens and unitality is valid in order to get this. And then from the above two, if you combine them, we can show that it has, in all cases, it holds that phi A intersection B is phi A times phi B. So there is no need for the additivity requirement to have deductive proof. This, the additivity requirement, or something else like this, is required to make proof by contradiction, which is not what we have in quantum theory. And the converse theorem also holds the evaluation map that is multiplicative obeys necessarily modus ponens. So this is quite strong motivation to keep multiplicativity, and it is one more reason why one would choose multiplication and drop addition or take any other sim. Which we actually, this was not historically what happened. I mean, this was a nice feature that arose. We didn't start like this, but it turns out to be the case. And the important thing is that in this formulation, all deductive proofs are still possible. So
quick question. Why do you feel that modus ponens is a more fundamental way of doing proofs than proof-like contradiction? Because if you thought they were sort of equivalent, you'd say,
no,
we have just as good reason for keeping additivity as we do for keeping...
No, I'm not sure that if we keep additivity, proof by contradiction is maintained first. And the second, I mean, there is a whole branch of mathematics called constructive mathematics that uses only constructive proofs rather than proof by contradiction. I'm not familiar with any, I mean, it's formulation, I mean, any basis of mathematics that they use only proof by contradiction and not deductive proofs. So, I mean, it really seems more fundamental. I mean, the other is also important, but yeah. I mean, I can live with the fact that not A is not, if A is not, is false, B is, might also not be true. I mean, the complement, but I cannot live, we cannot reason if we, I mean, this argument like Plato, we can't say make these type of sentences. I think we can't go far in logic, but anyway, that's what I mean. Actually, I think even intuitionistic logic also has the same feature. It keeps modus ponens and drops proofs by contradiction. It's nothing very strange. Now, the final part of the talk is concerning this paper by, well, Posse, Barrett, and Rodolf. I suppose some of you are familiar. I'll very briefly describe what they did there and then say what coevents say about, what coevent formulations say about this. So they showed that if we have two distinct pure quantum states, they necessarily, well, correspond to distinct physical realities. And according to them, this means that the state cannot be interpreted in a statistical way. Well, the precise meaning of what one means by statistical way is given in the paper. It's arguable, but they just proven that, well, so to speak, that the two pure quantum states correspond to distinct physical realities. We can stick to this if saying that interpreting statistical way is too profound, we can just forget about it for the moment. Okay, so the example they gave, the simplest example, but the argument carries over in other cases, is if they have two states, say 0 and plus, plus is 1 root 2, 0 plus 1. So there are two states that are not orthogonal, and they consider a pair of particles, again, that has that they have these two states. So they claim if psi naught and psi 1 are not distinct, so that it means that in some cases, not always, in some cases we can confuse psi 0 as being psi 1. That was their argument. So if they're not distinct. Now, so what they said is if we consider a pair of particles like this, it means that with some smaller chance, if 0 and plus are not distinct, that 0, 0, 0 plus, plus 0, and plus plus, we cannot distinguish some in some cases these four states. That's what they claim. And then they reach the paradox by saying, OK, assume that we measure the pair of particles in these bases. And then we can see that 0, 0, is orthogonal to this, so there is no chance that 0, 0 comes here. And then the second, there is no chance that... So if they make this measurement, they'll get one of the four results, and any result they take excludes one of these four possibilities. So in a sense, they said it's not true that we couldn't distinguish these four states, and if we can't distinguish these four, it means that we could distinguish 0 and plus. So that's roughly how it goes, their argument. Now, in the coevent formulation, well, different initial states give a different quantum measure. The quantum measure depends on the initial state. So if we have different quantum measure, we have different set of possible realities, set of possible coevents. So in this example, the statement is that there is no common coevent between the different initial states. So we have these four different quantum measures. For each of them, we get some possible realities, some possible coevents. And the statement is, if there was one common coevent, we could say, okay, sometimes this coevent is realized, and in these cases we cannot tell which of the four was actually realized. So this is a statement. So what we get in this particular example is that for initial state 0, 0, we have the quantum measure of H1 being 0, and therefore the possible coevents are these classical histories, H2, H3, H4. And similarly, for 0, plus, plus, 0, and plus, plus, we have these things. And now we see that, so these are the possible coevents if the initial state was this. These are the possible co-events if this was the initial state, and so on. And we can see that the intersection of these four is the empty set. So there is no common co-event between all these four. So in some sense, if in their argument they didn't specify what is real, they said that the reality of the state is something. So if the ontology of the system is co-events, we saw that this argument carries over. So in some sense, we could distinguish between the four alternatives if the ontology of our quantum theory were co-events. Okay, so I'll just summarize what we've seen. So we introduced the co-event formulation, which reality is a primitive, preclusive, multiplicative co-event. And it mimics classical physics, since possible realities can be identified as subsets of omega, but not singletons. It's a bit thicker, so a bit more coarse-grained reality. It evades the Cohen-Specker theorem, so there is no problem with Cohen-Specker theorem. We don't have classical co-events, but we have quantum co-events. And from the analysis of Cohen-Specker theory in terms of quantum covers, it was shown that there exist non-trivial co-events, maybe not many in every case, but there is at least one co-event for any case. Then we said a few things about classicality, didn't exhaust the topic, but we said that what we mean as classicality is that it arises as coarse-graining, and this, after some sufficient coarse-graining, we have a homomorphism, which this homomorphism is independent of which of the co-events is actually realized. So given the initial state and the dynamics of your system, I coarse-grain that much, and I know that I'll have homomorphism, no matter which of the co-events is actually realized. Then I think was that there exists a unique finest-grained classical domain in this language. Now, probabilistic predictions arose via the use of weak Cournot principle, as people claim that they arise in normal probability theory. This is under debate, as I understood. And the possible realities are still primitive preclusive co-events. This thing I mentioned doesn't work because it leads to contradiction. So the possible realities are primitive preclusive co-events, and predictions arise using the quantum measure in that way. Deductive logic is still applicable, as modus ponens is valid for multiplicative co-events, and actually modus ponens is an extra reason why to have multiplicative co-events. And finally, the analysis of that paper by Pouchet et al. Is confirmed if the ontology of the quantum theory are these co-events. So that was it. Thanks a lot.
Questions?
No, what you said in our response to Rob's question, I was just thinking the motivation for dropping proof by contradiction was kind of philosophical, as I understand it, the sort of suspicion of the concept of an unrestrained use of set theory. And that motivated people to try constructing mathematics without using modus ponens, without using proof by contradiction. I don't know that anyone's ever tried to see how much mathematics you can get if you drop modus ponens but keep proof by contradiction.
Okay, maybe, yeah. I just said it's a bit more standard. And first, and second, I don't know, I'm not at all, well, actually, most likely it's not the case that if I keep additivity, I'll have proof by contradiction. I don't think that this is the case. So it is the case that if I keep multiplicativity, I keep modus ponens. But I'm not at all sure that it's not.
If you don't have additivity, you don't have proof by contradiction. Isn't that true? So proof by contradiction implies
that. There isn't a theorem about that. I don't know. I don't think there is a theorem about that. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer.
Can I ask a related question to Mark? This is a kind of modification to logic. And there have been other attempts like that. So, for example, dropping the distributivity of disjunction over conjunction, and keeping the orthomodular law. Yeah. And so, one of the criticisms of that program, and I'm going to ask you to respond to this criticism for your program, was that if you think of logic as the theory of how to properly reason, then if you're going to suggest you know, modifying logic, then you have to do it across the board in you know, every area in which we try to reason deductively. And so some have argued that if classical logic is in fact the wrong logic, the wrong way to reason about the world, then we have to reprove all of mathematics using the new logic. And so the question of whether, you know, you can derive mathematics without proof by contradiction for these people would be relevant, because it would say that, you know, that what sort of hangs in the balance is whether you can really suggest that our logic should be replaced by this new logic. So I'm just curious, how would you respond to that demand?
Well, yeah, first of all, it's one thing I didn't point out is not directly related, I'll just point it out. Here, it's the logic that we arise, it's kind of dynamical. So it's not fixed, so it depends on the quantum measure. In some sense, it's not the logic we get, God-given. it relates to the quantum measure, therefore in the dynamics of the system. Well, this was not a response to what you asked, but just it was interesting thing that I forgot to mention.
What particular logical propositions are true depends, but you know, the fact that modus ponens holds and proof by contradiction does not.
Well,
there will be situations where proof by contradiction did hold.
Yes, definitely. To a classical partition, for example. Definitely, if you restrict the classical partition, it would hold. But as well, if your question didn't, I mean, so if the realized coevent, even if it's not a classical partition, if the question you ask doesn't cut the coevent that actually is realized, then you could do. So it's not that we can never use proof by contradiction. It's that it's dynamical, the cases that we can use and we can't use, so to speak. But modus ponens we can use in any case. So I view it less dramatic than the opposite way around. And it's the fact that we have a clear cut of where we can apply, because the picture is just that instead of a single history, we have a subset. And this is really realistic. It's there. It could be 2-3 histories, and it's just there. And just someone says that essentially what we say is that some questions, you could view it like this, I don't view it like this, that some questions are not allowed, in a sense. So questions that cut this coevent in the middle are not allowed. You could view it like this. It's not the way I like to view it, but someone can have this type of stand on this formulation. So it's like asking more fine-grained question than you would get an answer.
So what about...
So if you don't ask this type of questions, then you have classical logic.
So in the context of mathematical truth, if I said, normally we'd say there's a set of mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive propositions about mathematics, normally we would say one of those is true and the other is false. Would you say that's an arena in which we might apply anthropomorphic logic and say, actually all we can hope for is saying here's a set of mathematical propositions that are true and we can't specify which among them?
I don't know. Interesting thing to think about, but I haven't thought. I don't know.